and welcome to Wrestling and Everything Coast to Coast with your host, Buddy Sotelo Esquire, and Dr. Mike Leno, wrestling's premier photographer, and our special guest for tonight. Always wonderful to have him here and his many opinions on wrestling, and that is Ryan Bowman. And you're with the Pinfall, right?
I own a company, a marketing company called Pin, and then I also write for a website called Downing Into Sports, and they're my main employer, basically. My business is my side job.
Wonderful, very good. So, and you're all the way out in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, just an hour south of St. Louis.
Very good. So, not exactly coast to coast, but we're right near there. So it's far enough, and we at least cover the north and south of the California coast here.
Hey, let me just ask quickly before Russ gets going. Did you at all come to my 1991 Sam Muchnick 3-day weekend for the boys?
I was at a Sam Muchnick event when I was young, but I don't think in 91, I don't think I would have been old enough. I was only about 15 or 16 then, but I met Sam a little bit later through Herb Simmons.
The promoter. Okay. So the thing I had the Briscoes, Penny Banner, Fez was my lead MC, Ernie Ladd, Jimmy Snuka, Stan Hansen. I had a ton of folks there. Killer Kowalski, Ox Baker. You probably remember that.
Because I was at an event where Lou and Sam were both there at the same time, and that's the only time I ever saw or met either one of them, Lou Fez and Sam Muchnick. And of course, you know, being from St. Louis, originally from that area, you know, they were that was a big deal for me when I was younger, but man, it seems like 91 would have been before that, so I'm not sure.
All right, well, I wish you had, because it was, you know, celebrating Sam. O'Connor passed away, and his whole family there, and Missouri State title, you know, all that stuff from the times I shot at Keele Auditorium. One of the greatest territories ever. I'll shut up and throw to Russ.
Yeah, that's fine, but I agree, one of the greatest ever.
Yeah, no, it is interesting how St. Louis really does hold its own. It's there with, like, you know, and really Missouri itself is like a stronghold, like a Georgia or a Florida or Minnesota, you know, and that was
St. Louis, because it was athletic, right? It focused on athletes like Vern Gagne, similar to Eddie Graham, who liked getting amateurs. Most all the other territories, perhaps not, you know, I include Stu Hart in there, but St. Louis was far different. When you would see the Briscoes and the Funks and Johnny Valentine and Bobo and Dick the Bruiser and Harley Race, they had everybody. Everybody came in. Everybody wanted to work in St. Louis. I know Ryan probably knows that. It was such a big deal, and it was an honor to be able to shoot ringside at Keele Auditorium for, you know, X amount, and then wrestling at the Chase. The original stuff now that Billy Corgan's trying to recreate, you know, kudos to him. Have you gotten, Ryan, to that stuff?
I've seen some of Billy's stuff. You know, I mean, to me, I guess the NWA will never be, you know, the way it was when I was a kid, but then in wrestling won't be either ever the way it was when I was a kid. But I'm wishing him success. I mean, I'm glad to see the logo come back and the letters, you know, because of the tradition.
He had that event with Ric Flair back at the Chase Theater, you know, at the Chase Hotel. Yeah. So he had that thing. So he was doing about as much as you can in 2023 to honor St. Louis, and all that stuff, but pretty much everybody's gone. You know, the Garagiolas who did, Mike Gratchner, and everybody. Larry was Sam's right-hand guy for doing the program, ring announcing. Russ, gotta dig up, look at some of the YouTube stuff that's up there of that wrestling. It holds up today, like four Broadway Story Jr., Jack Briscoe, Billy Robinson coming in. I mean, all of the greats, everybody came in there.
And the all Sheep the Von Erichs.
Yeah, all the Von Erich kids.
I also think about Brody, you know.
Brody was the man in St. Louis. He was loved in St. Louis. I mean, he would be a heel everywhere else, but he was King Kong Brody in St. Louis instead of Bruiser Brody. They changed the name.
Because Sam was loyal to Dick Aplis, Dick the Bruiser. So yeah, couldn't use that. Similar to the other guy that was Crusher, he had to use a different name until they finally had the battle of Jerry Blackwell and Reggie Lisowski, you know, the two Crushers. But
and we had Bob Sweetan here too. I'm sorry, I mean, cut you up, but we had Bob Sweetan here also, and he was also the Bruiser. So, you know, it was kind of confusing with three of them here.
It's like the Canadian football teams where they have two Tiger Cat team's name, the Tiger Cats. It's like you got enough enough names out there. Pick something that, you know.
Well, the New York, both the baseball and the football team were called the Giants. You know, the Giants moved west, obviously, what was it, 1957 or 1961 to San Francisco. But at the time, they had the NFT as well as the St. Louis teams.
Cardinals and the Cardinals.
Yeah. That's what did they ever explain that, or did you ever get why, or was it just the bird was so popular, the red cardinal bird?
I remember as a kid, we always called them the St. Louis football Cardinals, because the Cardinals baseball team were the Cardinals, and then the football Cardinals were the other Cardinals in town, because, you know, the baseball tradition here.
It's insane. Sam Muchnick, before he promoted, he was part of the baseball writers, which was the class St. Louis Baseball Writers Association. Mm-hmm. He was a newspaper guy, Sam Muchnick. Mm-hmm. He's in a typical D's and D's, tough guy, old retired wrestler, Tony Galento promoter. No, he was a sports writer, well respected. I mean, when I threw that convention, all the newspaper guys, they all came to celebrate Sam. That is how much, not for anything else, they came to support Sam.
Yeah, so highly respected in the community, not just in the wrestling community, but in the city of St. Louis. So
I had to do it and get the support of the family. We had people donate to his favorite charity, the Arthritis Foundation of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. That is how big Sam was. Just a class gentleman, similar to Paul Bosch, although his office was not quite the museum Paul Bosch's was, but it was kind of a museum of stuff. I have checks. Canceled check from folks like Valentine, Gene Kaniski, the Briscoes, the Funks, Harley, Bobo Brazil, Ray Stevens from Sam Muchnick, the St. Louis Wrestling Club. Amazing.
So, I was going to talk about it later, but you kind of brought it up early. So I'd like to hear what you guys have to think, because you weren't on last week's show where we talked about this, which is the NWA and bringing back the idea of a territory system. And what do you think about it? And do you think it's going to be something that will ultimately be successful, or it just can't work in today's current environment? What do you guys think?
I know several of the people that were involved in the NWA, the mishmash of what it was. And I know, like, at one time, I think Bill Barron, my friend, was even the president of the NWA. Yeah. And he explained to me back then, you know, like, it was so confusing because you had so many promoters and so many people thinking that they were in charge. A lot of cooks in the kitchen. But I think Billy, he'll be able to get around that because he'll always be the centralized figure. So hopefully it works out. I mean, I have my doubts about a territory system today. But at the same time, you know, you'd love to see it come back. I mean, it's a great idea, a great concept. It was a great concept before.
And what are your thoughts? But you said, like, what are the you think the things that will challenge it to keep it from succeeding?
You're gonna have a lot of small promotions that, you know, they're gonna want to book the champion in front of 50 people, you know, and stuff like that. And that's gonna be a tough situation. If they're gonna do it, they gotta have major territories involved, not little small mom and pop places. I think that'll be the biggest problem, is finding enough money promoters that can get involved with the project and make it work and all fall in line and work together. That's the other part.
Because I was around all of those meetings when it got restarted. So effectively the true NWA died, say 83. And I would not include whatever Crockett had, because that was basically Mid-Atlantic. Yes.
They just had the title. Yeah.
Yeah. So after that, they had the title, and then it was a real mess when Flair took it up there, and then name change happened from NWA to World Championship Wrestling in 92, and you had Rick Rude and Muda and Sting and Luger and all NWA champions. But after that was the stuff you're talking about with Bill Bowman and Dennis Coraluzzo. He had me come. Mm-hmm. He brought me in.
There was a lawyer guy, and I can't think of his
name.
Oh,
that was later. He bought it. That was Bruce Tharp who bought it. It was a real mess. He wanted to be Sam Muchnick, except getting involved in angles and getting punched and taking the title to Japan with Steve Corino. And I like what Billy's doing. He's starting out just with one territory at a time slowly. So he's got EC3's developmental territory. It's got nice, great people that he's trained. It's got good TV product and stuff. But it's not going to be the way it was, because in the territory days, you had all of the territories, and I'm including Canada, where the NWA title would be defended, particularly like Winnipeg, where they bring in the NWA and AWA champion and have them go at each other. They didn't do that in Tri-WF at Madison Square Garden. They did it in Winnipeg. But you had obviously Toronto and Montreal and the Maritimes and Calgary with Stu. You had, and many of them recognized the NWA champion. The Babas All Japan did. And the NWA championship was defended in South America, you know, all talking venues and shows and stuff that had 10,000 or more. That's not going to happen today. So
yeah,
it's not going to approximate. Billy's got a good shot. He loves wrestling, and he,
but don't you think also this gives the ability to make, you know, the NWA and its shows more accessible to a wider range of
Well, everybody's show's accessible now. You have Ronda Rousey. I'm going to go shoot that. And Marina Shafar on the 18th. They're in a club in L.A. for Sammy Callahan's Revolver promotion. That's going to be a gigantic show.
Mm-hmm.
They had Ronda and Shafir at the thing with Taya Valkyrie and Ronda's trainer at Lucha Vavoom in L.A. not even a week and a half ago. No, the last great hope for the NWA, at least in my opinion, I hope I'm wrong, was NWA TNA when Jarrett started. Mm-hmm. They had the NWA championship. That was recognized, and you had national TV, or the, at least the pay-per-views when they started on Wednesdays, but they eventually got TV on Spike Network, and then it floated around, and they dropped affiliation. I forget, guys, Ryan, if you know why that split happened, and they no longer
not able to work with the NWA. You know, the deal was up and they couldn't come up with a new agreement on it, and so they just launched their own title. And I think that was 06.
Yeah, it was 06. You're right. Yeah, they went from NWA Russ championship to, and the first guy they had win that was an MMA guy, Kenny Shamrock.
Yep.
It's not going to happen, but hey, let's have Billy Corgan, one of the world's great top superstars in rock and alternative music. Let's have him prove us wrong. He does love wrestling. Prior to him doing this, for many years, he'd come to Cauliflower Alley. He was helping out Chicago Indies. A guy of that stature in entertainment, loving wrestling to helping out. There's a guy in San Francisco, Lars Fredrickson, who Russ, he came to a lot of APW, et cetera, shows, saw Russ manage. And he's, you know, mega with his band Rancid. That, you know, they do a lot of music for AEW, like Ruby, what's her name? Anyway, Ruby Riott, I forget what, Ruby Soho. That's her entrance music. That's an original Rancid song by Lars Fredrickson. I could see him doing stuff because he's been talking, he knows Billy Corgan well. So maybe we'll have rock musicians help out wrestling promoters. So, you know, let's hope for the best. I don't see it happening, you know, because AEW in this country and WWE and New Japan are far too powerful, and they're not, not going to have any involvement with it.
Even at this point, they're not even as big as Impact. I mean, the NWA isn't even as big as Impact, TNA, whatever they're calling it this week.
It's really growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah. I mean, they're a fourth or fifth tier company right now in America. So, you know, I mean, it's just kind of a tough situation.
People aren't watching it. On Thursday nights, it's 2 hours of Impact, which is pretty damn incredible. That Will Ospreay match with Speedball Mike Bailey off charts. That's one of the match of the year contenders, Russ. And then after the 2 hours every Thursday Impact on Access, you got New Japan, an hour of New Japan. You know, that's an unbeatable combo right there. So, again, let me ask you, Ryan, too, because we'll get back to Russ's NWA thing. It's still an important question. How do you budget the time? There's wrestling 6 nights a week, and then we're not including the streamers or the Lucha stuff or stuff online like MLW.
Well, I think being able to record things is the best. I mean, I don't think I don't have to cover shows, individual shows or anything like that as far as when I do wrestling work. But like, I don't know if anybody could review them live every night. They'd have to like
record. I'm trying, but I'm getting burned out. And now this Saturday, I don't know if there's going to be a a collision I have to tape going opposite their pay-per-view. They have their pay-per-view this, is it this Sunday or the Sunday after? I think it's 2 weeks. But they're going to
have. I can't keep track of the pay-per-views. It just seems like
they moved
every weekend.
They're doing Saturdays and Impact.
They're all starting to blur into, you know, one. You know, it used to be like when I was younger, I could tell you all the results of all the WrestleManias I'd seen and, you know, all the Survivor Series I'd seen and the Royal Rumbles I'd seen. And now it's like I can't tell you what happened in last week's Raw. Or last week's SmackDown. Well, it's mainly because I didn't watch it. But, you know, you get my point, is that all these shows are beginning to just blend together, and it's just becoming, it's hard for a match to stand out and stay standing out in your mind, because in 2 days, you see some other pay-per-view.
I am not going to forget the three-way lucha match was on Collision last night, where Hijo del Vikingo, his dad, mm-hmm. superstar in the 60s, early 70s, late 50s. So if you guys watch that is not forgettable whatsoever. That three-way was very cool. Penta won that one. But, you know, some of the stuff is not blendable because the matches just stand out. It's usually AEW. Let me ask you guys, even Russ, if you've watched Toni Storm, I'm doing this big, huge article for Evan on her, because the chin up tits out actually came from the 1930s from a roller derby star, and roller derby was just pro wrestling on a high speed bank track with skaters wheels. Annie Calvello came up with that expression. That's what she would tell the younger female skaters, chin up tits out, or tickets. Mm-hmm. That was the slang in wrestling and roller derby. Again, two interrelated entities, entertainment things that came from the carnival days. But tickets were a synonym for tits, and Annie Calvello came up with that. She took at least the chin up, you know, be tough from Hollywood, 1920s. So that's in my Toni Storm piece. What do you guys think of that now? You know, people bitch about, oh, there's not long-term storylines or character development. But what's-his-face who's in the wheelchair, who sneaks out of the wheelchair with the neck strong thing? Roderick Strong.
Oh, Roderick Strong, yeah.
That's the most over he has ever been, and I've followed him from day one. Incredible wrestler. Toni Storm, also incredible wrestler. This thing with her, so the pay-per-view that I'll be going to in L.A., she's going to be taking the title from Sheeta. I just don't know if they're going to try to have... Well, they can't. They're using a filter to make all of whatever film or when Toni Storm is on camera, it's got to be black and white, sort of like the Goldust stuff. And then they get the Sheeta and they're back in color. So then when they start fighting, I'm assuming they're just going to show it, you know, put the black and white filter on. But, you know, it started slow. There was a lot of bumps and stuff. And I thought they were going the way of what's her face in Impact when she had the smeared makeup, the Laurel
stuff. Allie, I think.
But they've kind of now blended a lot of, you know, I'm writing about all the Hollywood stars that Toni Storm's character is stolen from. Russ, have you seen this thing with Toni Storm playing this demented 20s actress? And now she's got, it's total Sunset Boulevard.
That's what I was going to say. It's the Sunset Boulevard takeoff. But it's awesome. I like it.
Yeah, I like it too. I think she's over and she's doing... It was clunky at the beginning, but now it's kind of hit its stride, and it's fun, and the place is popping for it. That's not forgettable either. That's not blending in with the WWE stuff. It's unique and different from the Bloodline. I'm getting tired of the Bloodline.
Yeah, you know, that was another topic, actually, that I was going to get to, and you've written about it on your Facebook page, so I thought it would be a decent topic for tonight, which is, you know, the never-ending reign of Roman Reigns. And has this been a good thing for wrestling or a bad thing for wrestling? Go ahead, Ryan.
I think it's been good. I found it entertaining. I think it makes the matches, the actual title matches, seem so much more important. Because even when I didn't want to see anything else on Crown Jewel, I wanted to see that match, you know, the main event match. Because there's always that chance of tonight might be the night he loses. It reminds me a lot of when back in the days in boxing, when Mike Tyson was so unbeatable. And then finally he got upset by Buster Douglas, and it was the biggest story of the year. Well, that's what I think will happen. Whoever gets Roman, it's going to be a huge event. And I think the more they build it, even though it's getting close to being time for it to end, I just feel like I think it's been great. I love seeing these long title reigns.
That part's good. The only part I'm going to say is Reigns has defended his title, at least on television and pay-per-views, very few times this year.
Yeah.
So when you talk about a guy like Bruno Sammartino, who 8 nights a week was defending that title, and then at the Garden and all of this stuff, Roman's not even in the same league. There have been so few, you know, what was the last time he defended his strap at a major pay-per-view? He's gone several pay-per-views without.
He only does 4 a year. He only does 4 defenses a year, pretty much.
I was going to say, I saw that it was only like 33 total defenses the whole time that he's had this reign.
Let me correct myself. The long-term story thing is fine, but it's kind of waning just for me only, perhaps, because you've got Jey Uso, you know, who's gone from it. It was clunky the way they had Jimmy come back. He quit, and then he was, you know, kissing ass and getting back into it, and you know, it's time for Solo Sikoa to take off. That guy is great as the third tertiary brother. But long-term stories, great. You know, nobody's done a storyline like this for, 2.5 years? This is Bloodline, I think, is at least 2.5 years, maybe longer. And continuously, and, you know, it's all the genius of Paul Heyman. But, you know, some weeks are better than others, and I've been... I think it's going to run out. Maybe not. Who knows?
Well, and I think in some ways they've compromised.
Cody is going to defeat my prediction of Roman at Mania. So that title's not changing hands till Mania. That's the only. And whether it's Cody, like most people hope, that's what he's being groomed for all this time. You know, having him lose, if they would have put the title on him last WrestleMania, people would have booed him out of the building. He's got to suffer some losses and difficulties, get through Brock Lesnar and all of this stuff. And so I think most people are pulling for, I don't know, what do you guys think Cody should be the
guy? I think they should have put the title on him earlier. So that's I disagree with you. I think that they've frustrated. First of all, there wouldn't have been any ill in having Cody and
a cap on him. No, that would have been, that would.
I think having Cody and Roman exchange titles, you know, a couple times this year would have been a lot more exciting than some of the matches that they've had Roman Reigns in otherwise, where you just know he's not going to give up the strap to, and they didn't have suspense. So, you know, I think that
but at the same time, they tried to build that thing to where he could surpass most of the guys. He's not going to surpass Backlund. He's already surpassed Morales, so he's not going to surpass Backlund, Hogan, or obviously Bruno. No way is he going to get close to Bruno.
He better not. I think that would kill the sport. That if he held it for 9 years, you know, I think that we'd all get worn out by that.
Three now.
And I think
it's impressive. The Usos
The fatigue is showing. Right. I think the fatigue is showing. I think the attention span of the average wrestling fan, you know, is being taxed by something like this. And that's one of the reasons why I'm excited about the NWA, because I'd like to see a champion have to go defend all over the place. And why not? You know, I mean, why not have a guy defend a title 4 times in a month? I think that's not a bad, you know, to me, when you look at like when Muhammad Ali or whatever, and I know boxing isn't the same as wrestling, but there was a time where showing stuff for free, title matches for free on TV was a regular sort of thing. And you don't see that anymore. And
you do. You see it in AEW. Max Jacob Friedman has defended that title, that world title, on free TV more times than anyone in AEW, more times than Kenny Omega's champion,
etc. It's good.
He's got one coming up this Wednesday that's like, yeah, can't miss.
Yeah, so no, I think it's much
Daniel Garcia is who's challenged Maxwell. He's got all of these people coming after him, Samoa Joe, Wardlow, and et cetera. Obviously, Switchblade, Jay White.
Ryan, so what's your thought?
You're getting that stuff free. That match, how good, you guys, or at least Ryan, if you watched it, the Omega-MJF match, mm-hmm. pretty damn good. And
he really put Max over too really well. I mean, he put him over just right because Omega still got star power, even though he's gotten older. But as far as what now I've lost. We the three of us jump around a lot. But now where were we at Russ before?
More title defenses is better.
No, I'm against that. Actually, I like less title defenses because I think they overdid it too much in the early 2000s when they were flip-flopping the titles all the time. And when you have that many championship matches, they feel the need, I think, too often to make a switch. Like, you know, you've got guys that are five. I think Sheamus has won the title five times. I mean, that means he's won it more than Bruno. He's won it more than Hogan, I think, or however, you know, whoever, some of the legends. You've got, like, just regular guys that are multi-time world champions. I'd rather have there be one strong guy for a long run than a bunch of different guys getting it, because then it doesn't mean as much.
Wait, you don't consider The Miz with his two title reigns in the same caliber as Bruno Sammartino?
No, not just a little bit behind him, just a tad behind Bruno, maybe.
Nobody touches Bruno. That my new tagline is, in deference to Disney, no, we don't stop talking about Bruno.
Right. You know, I mean, it's
song, we don't talk about Bruno. Well,
yeah,
I'm never going to stop talking about Bruno. There is nobody like him. And Russ, to your knowledge, in 68, Bruno came in and it was the IWF world title against Ray Stevens' U.S. title. The first one was a draw. And then the second one, it only went to the two falls. And then I think the time, you know, they couldn't finish the before curfew, 11 p.m., third fall. One of them got canted out. So that nobody, you know, it was title versus title. But Bruno came in. That was one of the few titles out. Well, was really, other than Japan, it was the only place Bruno defended that title outside of Vince Sr.'s territory boundaries. They didn't have guys like Superstar Graham or Backlund going down to Florida for one. So that was pretty historic. It happened in our own Cow Palace. It sold out both times.
But I also wanted, Ryan brought up on his Facebook page. Yeah, I pay a lot of attention to your Facebook page, other than your questions of the day, which I adore. But also, you brought up, and this is a really good question, what happened to cage matches?
Oh, God.
Yeah, why don't you, you know, tell our fans about what you said about cage matches?
Oh, I said that the cage matches don't mean anything anymore because people just still get into the ring anyway. So I said the cage is about as effective as a shower curtain because, I mean, they basically, they're going to find a way to get in somehow. And I miss the days when you locked two guys in a cage and it was going to be blood and guts and only one guy was coming out.
Can I say this quick before I have to leave? If you remember the blue cage that was at WrestleMania 2 with Bundy and Hogan, you know where cage came from? It was our Los Angeles LaBelle territory that I worked for as a ringside photographer for the program. It was our Blassi steel cage. And when cage matches were, I saw them in other territories. I think LA had some very exciting ones. That's what turned Freddie Blassi babyface in 1970. Three consecutive cage matches with the Sheik. The last one had Abdullah Farouk, you know, the Grand Wizard, Ernie Roth, suspended in a mini cage above it, the first territory to have that, to, you know, be well before Texas, etc. But the TriWF cage matches, when they finally started having them, it was kind of pussified. You know, they said, oh, either, you know, climb over it or go through the door. No, it was only climbing through the top of the cage. You had two guys who were like in their 50s, Blassi and the Sheik and later John Tolis, that had to, you know, these guys, they were legit scared of falling over and killing themselves. That's the way you won. I mean, Fred Blassi wouldn't even take bumps. He was too old, but he did those cage matches. And that cage got sold. Vince Jr. bought out our territory from promoter Mike LaBelle, December of 82. And that was one of the transactions. It went to him in the fledgling WWF, or Vince Jr.'s version of it, was our cage. And it was used, you know, quite a few times early on, the first couple of years, but most famously in WrestleMania 2, the LA part of the three cities, with Hogan against Bundy. Was it Bundy?
Yeah, I was there for that. I was actually at WrestleMania 2.
That was our cage. It came from our office. And Vince Jr. just happened to get it for peanuts.
So, what do you have a favorite cage match?
That's for the show.
You guys are going to laugh when I tell you my favorite cage match, and this is actually a moment I loved as a kid, but people knock it today. The cage match when Ronnie Garvin won the title from Ric Flair.
Because
he won it with, I'd never seen somebody win with a sunset flip off the second rope before. Like it was so unexpected. I loved that match. And then of course everybody pans Ronnie being the champ, but I liked Ron Garvin and I loved seeing Flair get beat because he was the heel, you know, and I was a younger guy. So, you know, I'm rooting for the good guy. So when he hit that move.
Snuka Morocco cage.
Yeah, see, I didn't see any of those when I was younger. I've seen them now, but I mean, I'm talking about as a fan growing up. I think that a lot of the NWA, the title matches with Dusty and Flair, those were always what I considered. Like, I was kind of a Mid-Atlantic fan after, you know, more into the after Wrestling at the Chase was gone and, you know, St. Louis was kind of dying down. I became a big Mid-Atlantic fan, and they just did cage matches so well, and they were also brutal. They all looked so brutal.
Yeah, now I saw Sergeant Slaughter and Kurt and Larry Henning in a cage match against the Road Warriors and Paul Ellering. Oh, we lost Mike, but
Minnesota.
And that was over at the Cow Palace. That was one of the most bloody matches that I've ever seen. It was, you know, but I liked cage matches were such a blow off. You know, when you had a winner or loser, like when Tito Santana fought Greg the Hammer Valentine. The Intercontinental Championship in the cage in WrestleMania, you know, or it wasn't WrestleMania, it was just a regular house show, I think, that they had that, where the title finally changed hands between Tito and Greg the Hammer Valentine. It was always, you know, the ultimate way to settle a grudge, and now it's like really kind of like an intermediate match. I mean, you just see him thrown in there whenever against just two kind of random guys that don't even have much of a feud against each other. They're just like, well, you know, we haven't had these guys in a cage yet, so let's just put them in a cage. I feel like the motivation to do a cage match has really lacked in the last number of years. What are your thoughts?
Used to be because there was too much interference. The heel would always have interference, and so you'd have a cage match to keep everybody out. Now it's just, we're just going to have a cage match, you know? And like you said, there's really no rhyme or reason to it sometimes.
It's not a buildup, and it rarely ends a feud anymore now. The feud continues, you know, after a cage match, and it feels like nothing gets settled. In fact, these specialty matches that used to be really traditionally a way for one wrestler to blow off, you know, a feud and then move on to somebody else because they finally defeated them in this ultimate, you know, specialty match, that philosophy simply doesn't exist anymore. And it just seems like it's almost like, well, it's your job now. It's your duty to have a cage match just because you've had this feud going for a while.
Well, the other thing too is just like the title changes, the more you have them, the less they mean. So, you know, it's again, like the bull rope matches. I've seen those are starting to make a comeback. Well, for a lot of years, you didn't even see those matches unless it was Texas or somewhere, you know, certain places, certain territories. But there were some towns that didn't wrestle certain gimmick matches. Now you go, or you might go somewhere in the Texas Death Match, obviously down in Texas, you know, was that kind of a specialty, you know, or whatever, you know, I Quit Match became kind of a signature thing in the Mid-Atlantic because of Magnum and Tully. But you just didn't see that every month like you do now. You didn't see a blow-off cage match every other week like you do now. And that's another thing. And then, like I said, the fact that they can get in the cage anyway, it's not really a secure environment. It defeats the whole purpose. The psychology of it means nothing.
Right. And that I agree with you about the psychology element of it. It used to be. Now, first of all, I've only ever managed one cage match in all the years that I was a professional wrestling manager. And I got to tell you, from a wrestler's side of view, or, you know, when you're managing something like that, the cage is actually pretty scary. It's not as flimsy or as, you know, easy to play around with as, you know, people seem to think. I got smacked in the face with the cage door, you know, in the match that we were in. that wasn't easy. That wasn't an easy bump to take. That was that, you know, that you get inside the cage and you're like, wow, okay, this is actually pretty scary. But, you know, guys aren't using the cage for spots very much. Mm-hmm. You know, they wrestle pretty much an ordinary match inside the cage and then use the cage only for like a couple of high spots or whatever, or, you know, climbing up high and doing a big jump off of it. But that's really all it's being used for. It's not really, you know, you don't see the guys raking each other's faces so much in the cage anymore, doing, you know, slingshots into the cage or high rope throws. No, you don't see that much anymore. And so that really takes the cage as a weapon out of it. And as you said, then you have all the interference, which was the other purpose of the cage being out there. And it really does defeat, you know, the kind of like, okay, these, you'll get to see these two guys face each other and you'll get a resolution. The winner of this cage match is the better of the two guys for the purposes of this feud. That was kind of the unspoken contract. And that is something that I miss. I miss that kind of feeling of like when something gets to that cage level, and then when you have a decisive winner, then it's time for that feud to end and move on to something else.
It's sort of like anything in wrestling. It's, and I think it's kind of like what you guys mentioned earlier about how a lot of these same gimmicks and stuff are just getting recycled over and over and over again. So it's good to see something original, you know, but at the same time, you know, you look at like the cage matches. It's the same thing I say with the hardcore stuff. At one point, how far are you going to go? I mean, you have people that are getting cut in the neck with light tubes and things like that. Like, how extreme do you have to be before it's not just, it's not wrestling anymore. It's criminal. And then again, what happens is they turn the notch up so much that the fans, if you don't almost kill yourself, you know, you're up the P word, you know, I don't want to curse on your show, but you know, I mean, you know, that's basically the way to look at those guys. So those guys are basically locked into always having to live that life. They're always going to be, and they're going to be bleeding every night. And that's what I'm saying. The same thing with everything, with title matches, with cage matches, with the hardcore stuff. You know, you can do it so much that the fans become numb to it.
Finishers being used as chain moves, you know, I mean, you know, especially if you try to show, you know, a modern wrestling viewer something from the 70s or the 80s. And I mean, for God's sakes, Ivan Putski's Polish hammer was one of the most successful finishing moves. And it's one of the, now you wouldn't even use that as like a mid-level move. You know, that's something that would just be completely brushed off, you know, in I mean, a guy just using both fists to hit a guy off the ropes. And that's,
well, you just brought up finishers. That's another thing, and how much they're. I just watched that match the other day. I don't know how many times you've seen Roman in this title throw his finisher 3, 4, 5 times in a match before he finally wins. You know, the way I was always brought up, and I know I'm not Roman Reigns. I never reached his level. I never worked for WWE. But just as the people that brought me along and taught me, you know, when I was young, always said, you always protect the finisher, especially for a babyface, because that's his. Bam, I got you, move. And so if he goes, bam, I got you, and the other guy goes, no, you don't, well, then it's not a finisher, you know, and it means nothing. The fans, I know what they do it for. They like that cliffhanger feeling for the fans, you know, like that near finish is a good little pop. But they, again, that's something they do way, way, way too much. Have a guy once in a while kick out of a guy's finisher to make it extra dramatic. I understand that, but I mean, my gosh, these guys don't have finishers. They don't, most of them don't have any kind of original gimmick. It's, you know, trunks and knee pads. And I understand that's how it used to be.
Don't get me started on Orange Cassidy.
Well, I find that entertaining. I'm getting more into the point now in my life where the stuff in the ring has started to mean less and less and less to me as I've gotten older. But it's just because I've been around promoters that have told me, you know, I'm not looking for wrestlers, I'm looking for stars, I'm looking for entertainers. So I've started to, my mentality now started to look at people like how TV ready are they, or how, you know, how much potential do they have as a star? Because I mean, I know some guys out there that can tie people in knots, but they're also ugly as homemade sin, and they're never going to get on television.
Yeah, they're Dean Malenko's. They don't have the kind of, you know, they're the Dan Severin types that, you know, just can't cut a promo and don't have charisma.
And if that was any of my friends out there and you heard that, I wasn't talking about you. So, no, I'm just saying, I've seen guys that you can tell they're great workers, but they're just never going to be marketable. You know, and I mean, that goes back to the same thing is, overdoing the technical stuff. I mean, the guys back in the day did not do 100 moves a match. They knew less is more, and they milked it. I watched a match, and I wish Mike was still on here. I watched a match. One of my favorite guys to watch from the golden era is Ricky Starr. Ricky Starr would get in, he would do all of his theatrics and everything else. I watched a whole match, and 3 minutes, he had the crowd going crazy, and the heel was going nuts. And you know what they never did in those first 3 minutes? Lock up. Not once. Ricky danced around him, and he played to the crowd. For those, because I watched the timer on the video, almost 3.5 minutes before they
ever. You know what's great at that, too, was Larry Zbysko.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He would get close to Playboy Buddy Rose. You know, they would get close to locking up, and then they would, you know, run their hands through their hair and complain to the refs and roll out of the ring and all that stuff. And, yeah, fans don't have that kind of sense of
anticipation. When they finally do lock up, it means more than it would have if they would have just locked up. I didn't mean to cut you off, but
I'm right with you on that. And, you know, it's definitely one of the things that I've noticed as well. And you know, you talk about it a lot on your Facebook page, and I know in your articles, you know, when you write. Speaking of, why don't you tell the fans a little bit about, you know, both projects that you're doing and how they can check those things out.
Well, you can find me at Bounding Into Sports or our sister site, which is covers pro wrestling, Ringside Intel. We have both of those. I also, of course, my book just came out this year. Well, you know this. My book came out earlier this year, Pop Music and Peanut Butter, and it's available everywhere. Amazon, I don't know, Good Books, all those sites, Barnes & Noble.
In fact, why don't you tell the fans what that book is about?
It's really mostly about pop culture from my generation, growing up in Generation X. And, you know, just literally there's chapters about, you know, going to the arcade when we were kids. But of course, I'm trying to tell it from a humorous perspective. You know, it's kind of, I don't want to say satirical, but it's kind of tongue in cheek look back at, you know, what it was like growing up in places. I talk about going to the family picnic. And of course, you can always find jokes at the family picnic because your family is funny. You know, so I always took I just took life experiences of mine that I found humor in. And I just put them each in individual stories throughout the book. Each chapter is a different story, a different column, basically. And so,
you know, arcades are coming back all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know all the stuff from when I was really young is coming. Now that I'm getting really old, it's all coming back. But no, it's funny because, you know, in the process of writing the book, everybody said, so this is probably going to be a great wrestling book. I'm sure it's going to be. And I was like, this isn't a wrestling book. You know, I'm not just a wrestling writer. And that's the one thing that I've always respected about people like yourself and you know, and other people I've dealt with in the wrestling business. You have certain people in the business that are just not very well-rounded. They're just wrestling, you know, and I know that you came up in the business. You were a manager, obviously, and at a much higher level than I was. I also worked on the indie level, but I also always wanted to keep a balance in my life. I love sports. I love comedy. I love, you know, so I always said, if I ever do a podcast, which has been talked about for 2 years, I would have to do a mix. I can't just do wrestling. I can't just talk all wrestling anymore because I think.
Why do you think I called this show Wrestling and Everything?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean,
the ability to sometimes talk to people about things that aren't wrestling. Like a couple of weeks ago, I had Jeannie Bassone on here from Hollywood, and we talked about our favorite horror movies. You know, instead. So it is nice to have I love talking with the people who are involved in wrestling because to a person, everybody, including you and all these other people have been fascinating. But sometimes you guys have different dimensions to you that isn't all wrestling based. And I always am interested in those things too. And I'm glad that you've accommodated me in that sense by being able to share those things.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is like, you know, I would probably want to do a show similar as yours. I've had sponsors and stuff before, but it's just been scheduling. You know, it's a commitment. And I've got a lot of commitments at home with work and my business. And I want to write another book next year. And, you know, it's just kind of, I have a lot of other things I've got going on.
What's the book that you're going to write next year?
It is kind of another look. It's going to be called 10X. So it's going to be 10 moments that help shape Generation X. And in each one, I'm like, for one example, one of the very first chapters I write about is the Berlin Wall coming down. I remember exactly when that happened. And I remember clearly the chapter is called Right Here, Right Now. Because that song by Jesus Jones, played that, and I was like a sophomore, junior in high school, and I remember that. Every time I hear that song, I picture the wall coming down. And so I
watching the world wake up from history.
Yeah, and so I put it about how it affected, you know, our lives in America, how it changed everything. You know, basically we're ending the Cold War, and so everything I'd grown up thinking about the other part of the world was now starting to change. And so I kind of use the song, the lyrics of the song, as a backdrop as I tell the story of that. And so that's what I always like to do. I like to incorporate song lyrics that people, they read it and they go, oh, I know that. That's from, you know, whatever song from the 50s, or, you know, music lyrics. I love using movie titles. I love little wordplay and symbolism and imagery. I mean, that's just, my wife always tells me, my wife and my daughter, my oldest daughter always says, you know, that way you write. And I'm like, what do you mean the way I write? And I don't know, just the way you do it, Dad. You know, I'm like, okay, well, yeah. I mean, I guess I have a unique way of doing things, but I had a lot of good teachers. So I was able to take a little bit of from all of them and just kind of meld them together into what I became, you know, which I think is a pretty decent writer. Not great, but decent, you know.
Is Hulk Hogan pinning the Iron Sheik one of the moments that shaped Gen X?
I was thinking about that one, or I was thinking about well, see, then I was gonna say like the Monday Night Wars, because it was kind of like we were
that was big too,
you know, or we were in our college years then, you know,
or like, the first WrestleMania. I mean, that was the first really big hit of the pay-per-view scene, and think about what pay-per-views have been since.
I've been trying to think of that, because I know there's got to be one pro wrestling reference, one chapter that's about a moment in pro wrestling. And I mean, mine was either going to be first time my dad took me to a wrestling match and how much it changed my life, or
my dad and I never went to wrestling. He was,
oh my gosh,
he hated my wrestling connections, never saw me perform, never wanted to even talk about it. He was utterly embarrassed to the core of his being. I was such a big wrestling fan.
Mine, it's such a weird story. My dad was a drill instructor in the Air Force, and so funny.
My dad was a captain in the Air Force as a
really
doctor. Yeah. But continue.
But so I'm an Air Force brat as well, you know. So but so it's so funny. I moved here to this town. Like maybe I was renting a place about five years before he did. Then they moved down here, him and my mom. And then it was about 6 months after that, I bought the house a block away. So my dad literally lives right down the street from me, which is great, because now that my mom's gone, I'm here right here if he needs me, and he's here if I need him, you know. So it's kind of like we've got each other. And so he always, even though he didn't really understand the wrestling thing, he always, for a guy that was a drill instructor and you would think would be a real hard ass, he was probably he's my best friend to this day, you know? So, I mean, he didn't bring work home with him. I'll just put it that way. He was tough on us when he needed to be, but he never hit us. He never made me do push-ups or anything like that. But, you know, it was just kind of one of those, he's just always been, you know, like my rock in life, you know? And so, you know, I guess, but then again, I didn't get to see him do a lot of military stuff. You know, he didn't see my wrestling things until later. He saw me as a writer, but he didn't see me, you know, perform or be, you know, I've done a lot of play-by-play and ring announcing and stuff for these small companies. It would have been cool to have my dad there a couple of times, but he was always somewhere else. You know, I was always in Kentucky or Tennessee or somewhere like that. And he was, you know, in Missouri or Illinois or wherever.
Wow. So I also wanted to find out, since you mentioned video games as part of the thing that shaped Generation X, or in your book, what was your favorite video game from the 80s?
Oh gosh, like the stand-up arcade games. Honest to God, there was a game
called either Defender. One, either console or stand-up. But let's go with
games. Was Defender? Or no, I'm sorry, I guess not Galaga. Anything that you get to fly around in a spaceship and shoot things. That's all that mattered to me. If there was because I guess when I was a kid, I liked Star Wars and all that stuff, the original Star Wars stuff. And so I remember playing Galaga and Defender all the time. Those two.
I could not get enough of wrestling video games back in the day. So I was always playing the WWF Superstars game. I was always playing WWE's the Saturday Night's Main Event. One, you know, WrestleFest, or do you remember that they had a tag team wrestling game by Data West mm-hmm. from Japan with the two tag? Nobody had names. There was just a big burly guy and a masked guy versus two guys that looked like the Briscoes.
Mm-hmm.
Just like tap the button really fast and pick a move, and you only had like 8 moves to do out of the. I was fascinated with that game.
Well, I was addicted to the original Pro Wrestling by Nintendo.
Oh yeah,
they all look like.
That stupid song will probably haunt me in all eternity when I go to wherever you go in, you know, for when you're done on this plane. That song will be there. That thing is burned completely into the cortex of my brain. I can't get that out of there. And I never beat that game. I know that you faced the Grand Puma at the end, and I did that one time, and he kicked the crap out of me. And then, you know, the game ends, and you can't, like, restart it back at that spot. So you'd have to go all the way back through, you know, to face it again. And I just never have had the chutzpah to try to play it again, even as an emulator.
But now, when you go, now not consoles, but when it moved to the Nintendo era, it was definitely Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. I played that game like crazy because I was obsessed with finally getting to Mike Tyson and winning, which I did. And honest to God, to this day, here's the funniest thing is I believe if you gave me enough time, I could think of the code that you punched in to get to Mike Tyson.
That's wow.
This was when I was 14. This is 30 something years ago. And it's just like, you know, again, you remember those things from when you were a kid. So funny, the stuff that you nowadays, I can't remember what happened on Tuesday.
Sure.
But
or that password you really need to remember to get into your banking account or whatever.
Or where your car keys are. Yeah, I mean, but I can remember stuff that happened in the fifth grade at somebody's lemonade stand.
Or it's left, like right, left, 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 up, down, punch, left, punch, right, up, down, left, you know, to get infinite men or something like that. Yeah.
003-373-5963. That was the
code. Wow.
Now, once you started saying up, up, and then I was like, oh, yeah, I remember. Because I remember it rhymed, as you said, they were like a set of Social Security numbers. Like, seriously.
It's amazing. It's amazing how the human mind works. So why don't you also tell the fans a little bit about PIN? Is it pinned or is it PIN?
It's pinned. Like as
a PIN.
And it basically started out as a marketing company, and now I've kind of been representing a few guys just here and there. I've mostly done PR work and marketing for them, but then again, you know how it is when you know how you and I are probably both about one degree of separation from just about anybody in the business. So the young guys that know me will say, well, do you know such and such? And I'll say, yeah. And so we've worked out some different, I made a few business deals in wrestling, you know, like getting people promoted and things like that. I wouldn't call myself an agent by any stretch of the imagination. My buddy Franco calls me his agent, but I'm like, I don't know if I'm so much your agent as I'm your buddy and I'm going to help you out, but I'm not, this isn't my career by any stretch of the imagination. But it is funny because, and I hate this, I don't want people to take this term the wrong way, but somebody told me a long time ago, they said, you'll find out as you get to meet people more and more. And I don't know why this term always struck me as so funny, but he told me, it was one of the older guys, he said, you're going to find out wrestling's the most incestuous business you've ever been in. In other words, what he meant was not like incest, like in the, what he meant is we're all related somehow. After a while, you end up being, you know, a distant cousin to somebody.
Yeah, it's a really strange family, isn't it? You know, mm-hmm. I've always looked at the wrestling friends that I have, and it is a family. In fact, you know, I was going to mention it to Mike here, is that this week marks the both the anniversary of the death of Roland Alexander, who was a big deal at All Pro Wrestling, and Mark Bison Smith died next week. And, you know, I mean, Mark still was a big deal to me, and losing him was a huge friendship of mine that, you know, this now makes 12 years. Hard for me to, like, believe he's been gone for 12 years. But he was gone 12 years ago. And I mean, I think about him all the time. And, you know, you make friends in this business. Sometimes you make enemies of people that you wouldn't want to pee on them if they were on fire. But there are also guys that that touch you during this time that you're in this business that you just, they never leave your life. Even when they leave your lives, they never leave your life.
I'm kind of one of those people that most people in wrestling, in actually in wrestling, I would never, I don't think I could ever blow up at. Now, some of the guys that have covered it, some of the dirt sheet, so-called, I've blown up on them and just said, don't even bother talking to me anymore. You know, because it's just like, you're on the peripheral of everything anyway. You're not any higher ranking than I am and all this. And especially if it comes down to business, I'm hyper emotional when it comes to my business, you know, and my money. So I may have cussed a few people out over my years of doing things, but you know, I mean, I look at it like this. I've also been taught by pro wrestlers over the years that you better stand up for yourself when it's time to, and it doesn't matter how big or small the person is. You have to have the guts to say, no, you can't do that. Maybe I do get a little pissy but like I said, we've also come up around a lot of rough people. So I'm used to people yelling and screaming and cussing and things like that. And the boys might get in a fight in the back and then be out the bar together later on that night, you know? So, I mean, it's just a different world and a different life and different kind of people. I mean, so you have to be a little different to be one of us, to be honest with you. I'll be straight up with you. I mean, you have to have thick skin and you have to be able to, breathe fire when you need
to. You have to have thick skin, and sometimes you have to have the thick head to be in this business. You know, you got to be stubborn and a little bit stupid to be in this business. It goes a long way. The stupid goes a long way. But if you don't have that little bit of stupid, then you don't belong in wrestling, because it is stupid. I mean, if you really look at it from a really outside perspective and looked at it from, like, you know, an alien being looking at it, they'd say fake fighting. What's, you know, why, you know, prearranged matches, all of that. Why would anyone care about that? It's so stupid. Yet the drama involved in all of it, and the human stories involved in all of it, and the fact that it's still something that, even with mixed martial arts and boxing and video games and all these other things, there's still a desire to see people want to perform as wrestlers, is something that I think is endemic to the human spirit. It's just who we are as what we've evolved as creatures, that we like that, seeing that kind of action in front of us, even when there are alternatives. Because
I'm very, very close friends with Sean Stasiak, and we have a lot of talks or whatever. And he goes, you know, he said at the end of the day, you know, he says, you know, you got to look at it. You have to have passion for what you do and everything else. He said, but at the end of the day, to other people, we're just a bunch of half naked folks pretending to fight. Or he said, a bunch of people are in underwear pretending to fight, you know, and I didn't think about that. But I said, to an outsider, that's what it is. But I'll go back to referencing what you said. I have a friend who does these. Are they like medieval, where they stage the medieval fight?
Yes. I mean, the society is SCA.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. And he's a young guy. This guy's like a clean cut. I mean, this young black guy, he's clean cut. He looks like he would be so cool. And to me, that is the nerdiest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm just like, why? How are you?
Hey, it's like Civil War reenactors.
Yeah, well, I'm the same way with that stuff. But to them, that's what pro wrestling is to us. We're like, that makes total sense to him. And he loves it. Just like I love wrestling. So it's like, you can't, I mean, as much as people made fun of wrestling and me being a wrestling fan when I was young, because, you know, it's fake. You know, it's fake. If I had to hear that one more time. But, you know, to him, I don't understand that, but he loves it. So, you know, I mean, I'm when I say that too, I don't give him a hard time about it or anything, you know, but I always thought when I saw those people, I was like, man, these people have like no lives or something, you know, because you think, you know, when you think when you're in wrestling or you're around wrestlers and stuff, you're really cool, but you don't realize there's other people looking at you like you're just a bunch of circus people, basically, you know. And I know
that's how my dad looked at me. You know, he's like, why would you voluntarily put yourself with all these, you know, lower echelon people, you know, because, you know, you're better than that. But, you know, I used to hear that from my dad all the time. Why don't you do Shakespearean acting? You know, it's like you could be an actor on stage. You could be an actor on the screen. I'm like, I couldn't do that kind of acting for 5 minutes. You know, being a manager to me isn't acting. Do you know what I mean? When I got out there and I was Buddy Sotelo, I wasn't acting. I was Buddy Sotelo. I became that person that I was as a manager by the time I was out there ringside. And that was very hard for my dad to understand, but you know, it's what gets the essence of what makes people professional wrestlers or Civil War reenactors or a Society for the Creative Anachronism or what have you, you know, performers in that. That's the element that drives us. And it drives people to sing and to act and to do all sorts of things that are outside their regular comfort zone, because as human beings, we'll always want to do that. We're always going to want to push that envelope.
When I was younger, the first time I went and they gave me the microphone and I went in front of the crowd and I didn't even know what I was doing. I just thought, I'm going to do this. Like, I'm just going to just do this as excited as I am. I'm going to be try to get the crowd. So I go out and I mean to tell you, the first time you go out in front, and this is how I would explain it to somebody, who's the first time you do something that makes the crowd just lose their minds, that's the highest high you will ever have in your life. There's no alcohol, no pill, no smoke, no shot, no nothing that will make you feel inside that good at that moment. And then you crave it.
That'll make you go and show up in Antioch on the middle of summer when it's 98 degrees out and then a crowd of like 15 people. And, you know, you'll still perform like crazy. Or if you're in front of 5,000 people, you know, at a major arena, you know, and normally you'd be terrified, you know, to do something like that. I agree with you that performance is the ultimate drug. And that's why, you know, for a lot of wrestlers, when that ends, that's something that they can't deal with. They try to replicate it with drugs or with other things, and it never comes back. And that's why that movie, The Wrestler, if Evan was here, we could, you know, point it out, was such a genius about it, because that's the first time, in my opinion, that they ever conveyed in a wrestling character on screen what it was like when you weren't in the ring.
Well, that's what I don't understand. A lot of the boys don't like that movie. A lot of the old timers and stuff don't like that because they say, "Oh, it makes us look bad." I said, "Yeah, but I know more guys in the business turned out like that than turned out like you." You know what I'm saying? Like, I'll give you an example. You talked about somebody that I luckily one of the people that I know that he's got. I know that the way he passed and some of the problems he had were there. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Everybody knows about it, but. Before he passed, I had the chance to get to know. When I was very young, I met Axel Rotten. And every time I'd run into him anywhere, he was always right there with me, telling me, now, you know, giving me advice and stuff like that. Really cool. And when I found out that he'd passed, it was the same kind of thing as you. It's like one of those things. Every time there's just a certain time I'll think, I'm going to get up and watch a video about him. And it wasn't like we were best friends or anything, but it was just somebody that I respect. I had seen on television. He was the first guy that I'd ever really seen on national television, really kind of helped me and take me under the wing. And at the time was still on that. He was still in ECW. And then he went to WWE. And all that stuff. And I just was always like, man, that was a guy that didn't even have to talk to me when I was a kid. And he always treated me like an uncle or something, you know? But you know what? There's a lot of older guys in wrestling, a lot of the veteran guys that always did that for me. They were always good about, if you showed interest and you listened, if you were willing to listen and not do this the whole time, you could absorb anything you wanted, because they know it all. I don't.
Well, you know a lot, Ryan, and it's, I can't believe that it's already been an hour. I know you were tired and you didn't feel like doing the show, and then all of a sudden
I wanted to apologize to you for my voice and looking so pasty. I'm just getting over this flu, but like I said, we haven't done this. I guess I told you before we went on, we haven't done this in a long. We need to do these more often.
I love having you as a guest. I really do. I even though you're all the way in St. Louis and I'm all the way out here in California, I feel like we've become friends over the years. And I always look forward to what you have to say on the show and the input that you give. And I've only scraped the surface. You have so much knowledge, and I've only scraped a tiny little bit of the grand knowledge that you have with you. So, you know, we'll have you on again in the future. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show this week. When you're ready to come up with your next book, we'll definitely have you on so you can promote that too. And anything else, anytime you want to be on the show, you're welcome to be on.
I want to thank you first for saying that I had so much knowledge, because my kids don't think so.
Yeah,
so somebody does.
Same here. I give them precious nuggets of wisdom all the time, and they just look at me like, what the hell, Dad? Just shut up and make sure the computer works and get us to McDonald's. You know, that's all I'm really good for these days. Well,
that's what I think most fathers are only good. I mean, that's kind of your job when you become a dad. So.
Just because I can drive. That's like my only real value to them at this stage.
Yeah, you become the cabbie more than
anything. Yeah, once they learn how to drive, then it's off to the retirement home, off to the glue factory for me. But yeah, no, but I recognize that you have knowledge, and I'm glad that you're able to share it with our viewers, because I think the ones that do tune in get a lot from every time that you're on our show, and I really appreciate it. And even though you're under the weather, to give us a full hour here has been wonderful. I've learned a lot.
I just hoped I wasn't too low energy, because I'm usually pretty hyper anyway, so it's kind of, you know,
it's what comes from here, not what necessarily from here, but when it comes from here, that's when we get the value, and you always are willing to share that with us, and I really appreciate that so much, and so do our listeners too. So anyway, I'm gonna let you go get some sleep, my friend, and we'll be in touch real soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, good night, everyone.
Bye.